From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
They were released. Congressman Foley resigned, and I'm glad he did. If he had not, I would have demanded his expulsion from the House of Representatives.
Calls are increasing for House Speaker Dennis Hastert to resign over his handling of the Mark Foley scandal. We'll speak with a reporter at the Hill newspaper and the ABC News producer who first obtained the sexually explicit internet messages Foley sent to underage male congressional pages. Then a look at one of the country's most controversial cases involving the prosecution of activists for animal rights. We'll be joined by the first convicted member of the Shack 7 to go to jail, Andrew Stepani.
This afternoon, I'll be turning myself into the U.S. Marshals on what is being considered terror-related charges for my involvement with a peaceful protest against an animal testing laboratory, Huntington Life Sciences.
And war resistor Daryl Anderson has returned to the United States after spending 2 years in Canada. He was the first Iraq war vet to flee to Canada in order to avoid returning to Iraq. He plans to turn himself in today at Fort Knox in Kentucky. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. North Korea has announced it intends to carry out nuclear weapons tests in defiance of the United States. The North Korean government released a statement today saying the test would be done as a response to threats and sanctions from the Bush administration. North Korea has previously said it has nuclear weapons, but it's never carried out a test to prove its claim. Japan and other countries criticized North Korea for threatening to go ahead with the test. On Capitol Hill, calls are increasing for House Speaker Dennis Hastert to resign over his handling of the Mark Foley scandal. Foley is the Republican congressman from Florida who stepped down Friday after it was revealed he'd sent sexually explicit internet messages to underage boys that used to work as pages on Capitol Hill. The conservative newspaper, The Washington Times, called today for Hastert to resign his speakership. Hastert knew about some of the internet messages for months, but took no action. On Monday, ABC News reported it obtained more messages written by Foley to underage boys. In one exchange, he made repeated efforts to get a teenager to meet him at night. Foley wrote, quote, "I would drive a few miles for a hot stud like you." The White House is attempting to downplay the severity of Foley's actions. White House Press Secretary Tony Snow said Foley's offense was sending, quote, "simply naughty emails." We'll have more on this story in a few minutes. The State Department has confirmed Condoleezza Rice was personally briefed by then-CIA Director George Tenet about the threat posed by al-Qaeda 2 months before the September 11th attacks. The July 10th, 2001 meetings discussed in a new book by Bob Woodward. According to the book, Tenet went over top-secret intelligence pointing to an impending attack and sounded the loudest warning to the White House of a likely attack on the United States by bin Laden. Tenet said he felt Rice brushed off the warning. When Woodward's account first emerged over the weekend, Rice initially suggested no such meeting had ever taken place. The Center for Constitutional Rights has filed the first legal challenge to the new Military Commissions Act passed by Congress last week. The legal group has filed a habeas corpus petition on behalf of 25 detainees held at Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan. The petition demands the men be released or be charged with a crime. Some of the detainees have been held for years without ever receiving a hearing. Under the new bill, prisoners have no right to challenge their detention. On Monday, Bill Goodman, the legal director for CCR, warned about the dangers of the new law. Bill Goodman with the Center for Constitutional Rights will try to bring that clip to you later. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we continue with our headlines. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist visited Afghanistan Monday and acknowledged the United States might never win the war against the Taliban. He said there are now too many Taliban fighters and that they have too much popular support. Frist said backers of the Taliban should be brought into the Afghan government. In Mexico, President Vicente Fox is warning force could be used to crush a popular uprising in the state of Oaxaca. Fox made the comments on Monday as Mexico marked the anniversary of the 1968 student massacre in Mexico City.
Y mientras exista la posibilidad de llegar a un acuerdo,
while the possibility exists to reach an agreement, we will continue to insist on it, in reaching an agreement and resolving everything in that manner. If this does not happen, violations of the law must always be stopped and must be punished. The government is ready to fulfill its responsibility on both accounts. First, to promote a dialogue to look for a democratic understanding, and second, to always uphold the application of the law.
Over the past few months in Oaxaca, tens of thousands of striking public school teachers and other protesters have launched a widespread campaign of civil disobedience. The protesters are calling for Oaxaca Governor Ruiz Ortiz to resign. Protesters have blockaded streets and government buildings have taken over the state-run television station. This is Alberto Ramirez, a leader of the Armed Revolutionary Organization for the People of Oaxaca.
They were spy planes because they flew over with their lights switched off. They bought a surveillance dish. We knew that was a radar. So you can see the military, the way they see the situation is that we have taken over Oaxaca and maybe they consider us enemies of the nation. Because only if this is so, they can allow this kind of treatment that we are being subjected to from the Mexican government.
In other news from Mexico, the country's president-elect, Felipe Calderón, has urged President Bush to veto a bill authorizing the construction of a 700-mile fence along the U.S.-Mexico border.
We must understand that migration cannot be reduced by decrees or physical obstacles that only make migrants take greater risks and, as a consequence, produce more unjust deaths on the border.
In Washington, the State Department maintains the wall is needed. This is Thomas Shannon, U.S. Undersecretary for Latin America.
We are building barriers that allow us to manage and control how people move across borders. We need to know who's coming across our borders. And after years of not paying as much attention on the frontier as we should have, we are now attempting to come to terms with it.
At the United Nations, South Korean Foreign Minister Ban Ki-moon is poised to be elected the next Secretary General. He'll replace the outgoing Kofi Annan. In Lebanon, the Beirut Bar Association is demanding Israel be tried for violating international law during its offensive on Lebanon. On Monday, the Bar Association met with investigators from the UN Human Rights Council. Meanwhile, Lebanese President Emil Ahoud called on Israel to stop occupying the town of Gajar in southern Lebanon. Ahoud said many issues remain unresolved.
The National Lebanese Army will raise the flag along the blue line, but there are other issues to be resolved. These include the border area issue. They also promised us to find a solution to the disputed Sheba farms after the cessation of the Israeli aggression, which is the origin of all problems. At the same time, the Israelis have not handed over mine maps. They told us this war is all because of the captured Israeli soldiers, but nobody is mentioning them now. We also want our detainees.
Human Rights Watch is calling on the newly appointed interim prime minister of Thailand to immediately restore fundamental rights as the first step toward a return to democracy. The backers of last month's military coup have banned political gatherings and put in place media censorship rules. Soldiers were initially placed inside newsrooms at TV and radio stations. More than 300 community radio stations in Thailand's northern provinces were closed down, and at least 10 anti-coup websites have been taken off the internet. In Pennsylvania, a gunman entered a one-room Amish schoolhouse Monday and shot 11 girls in the head. Five of the girls died. The six others are in critical condition. The man, a local milk truck driver, entered the schoolhouse and ordered all the boys and adults to leave. He then ordered the girls to line up facing the blackboard. After he tied them up, he shot them all in the head. This marks the third school shooting in the past week. Last Wednesday, a gunman took six students hostage at a school in Colorado. The gunman sexually assaulted the girls and killed one of them. And on Friday, a 15-year-old student shot dead a teacher at a high school in Wisconsin. And the Federal Communications Commission is holding a two-part public hearing today in Los Angeles on media ownership. The first meeting starts at 1 p.m. at the University of Southern California. Then at 6:30 p.m., the hearing resumes at El Segundo High School. All five FCC commissioners are expected to attend the meeting. The Republican-led commission is considering plans to rewrite rules on media ownership to allow for greater media consolidation. And finally, the Center for Constitutional Rights has filed the first legal challenge to the new Military Commissions Act passed by Congress last week. The legal group has filed a habeas corpus petition on behalf of 25 detainees held at Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan. The petition demands that the men be released or be charged with a crime. Some of the detainees have been held for years without ever receiving a hearing. Under the new bill, prisoners have no right to challenge their detention. On Monday, Bill Goodman, the legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, spoke in New York at a rally sponsored by the group World Can't Wait. On Thursday, World Can't Wait is organizing emergency protests in over 170 towns and cities to condemn the government's sanctioning of torture. This is Bill Goodman.
That no one can be held indefinitely, and if they are, they have a right to go in front of a magistrate and a judge or a judge and demand that they be, that the judge make a determination as to whether they're charged with a crime and whether there's any real evidence to hold them. And if there is not, the magistrate, the judge, can order the king, the police, the FBI, or anyone, or George W. Bush, the President of the United States, to let them go. That's what habeas corpus is. Without it, we are virtually slaves to a police state.
Bill Goodman of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and those are the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today by looking at the Foley congressional scandal, which has rocked Washington, D.C., 5 weeks before the midterm elections and could cost the GOP control of the House. Mark Foley, a Republican congressman from a wealthy district in Florida, resigned Friday after ABC News revealed he exchanged sexually explicit internet messages with teenage boys who used to work as pages on Capitol Hill. Yesterday, Foley checked himself in to rehab, stating he was being treated for, quote, alcohol and emotional problems. Meanwhile, the FBI has begun examining whether Foley broke federal law, and top Republicans are being charged with covering up his misdeeds. Speaker of the House Dennis Hastert initially claimed he just learned about Foley's actions, but Republican Congressman Thomas Reynolds later revealed he'd personally told Hastert months ago. Hastert allowed Mark Foley to remain the co-chair of the House Caucus on Missing and Exploited Children up until Friday. This is Speaker Hastert yesterday.
No one in the Republican leadership, nor Congressman Shimkus, saw those messages until last Friday when ABC News released them to the public. When they were released, Congressman Foley resigned, and I'm glad he did. If he had not, I would have demanded his expulsion from the House of Representatives.
ABC News chief investigative correspondent Brian Ross broke the story Friday when he published transcripts of some of Foley's online exchanges. This is an excerpt of his report on ABC's Nightline last week.
His fellow Republicans had no idea the resignation was coming.
None of us are very happy about it. Thank you.
Other questions?
In Congress, Foley was part of the Republican leadership and the chairman of the House Caucus on Missing and Exploited Children. He crusaded for tough laws against those who use the internet for sexual exploitation of children.
They're sick people. They need mental health counseling. They certainly don't need to be interacting with children.
Maddie Sauer joins us in the studio now, producer with the investigative unit ABC News, and has produced the stories on the Foley scandal with correspondent Brian Ross. Jonathan Kaplan joins us in Washington, D.C., a staff writer with the Hill newspaper, has also been following the Foley story. Maddie Sauer, let's begin with you. First of all, welcome to Democracy
Now! Thank you.
Tell us exactly how this went down. Tell us how you developed the story.
Well, it started on Thursday when we ran a story on our website after we had obtained some emails that were written to a 16-year-old former congressional page from Congressman Foley that the page had forwarded on to a congressional staffer saying that they made him uncomfortable. And these were certainly not the sexually explicit emails we later obtained, but they were strange things that you wouldn't think that a congressman would be writing to a junior in high school. What do you want for your birthday? What kind of stuff do you like to do? I like to work out. I like to keep in shape. And it was enough that the young boy had gotten a little freaked out by it and forwarded it along to a staffer. And those were the emails we had initially obtained, and we did a story on that on Thursday.
And how did you get this information?
They were passed to a colleague from mine from a source. Not someone from a Democratic campaign, a source on the Hill. And when we talked to Foley's office about those emails, they seem to know all about them. It's no big deal. He's overly friendly. He's overly engaging. If he's guilty of anything, that's all he's guilty of. He's very close with the pages. He's worked with the Page program for some time. So we published that story, and then almost immediately we began receiving emails from former pages, some going back as far as 5 years, who said, this is the tip of the iceberg. There is so much more here. And Thursday night, I started reaching out to them by phone and email and talking to them Thursday night and Friday morning. And Friday morning, I received transcripts from two different former pages that were instant messages between former pages and the congressman. And they were very sexually explicit, and they were very similar. Both of them contained similar language, similar requests that the congressman had asked the young boys to do. And
this was the one saying the teenager should strip and he wanted to grab his penis.
Yes, and he had asked both of them to measure their penis. And it was enough that I went to Brian Ross with these saying, you know, what do we do now? And of course, because they're instant messaging transcripts, it was very hard to judge whether they were authentic or not, because anyone could hypothetically type one of these up. So there really was no other option but to go to the congressman's office with this and let them know what we found. So I called the press person for Congressman Foley. I had let him know that I'd obtained two transcripts from two different former pages regarding internet messages with former pages. And they asked me for a copy of them, and I had to refuse because that would have let them know who the pages involved in these communications were, and I wasn't ready to do that. So he asked me to read him the transcripts, which I did, and
This is the press person?
This is the press person, and it was one of the strangest press conversations I've ever had with a press person for a congressman, because I've never ended that conversation saying, so the question is, does the congressman engage in sexually explicit internet messages with teenagers that worked as congressional pages? And when he had to tell me, he'd call me back on that one. I knew we had a problem here. So it was, I'd say, an hour, maybe, that we got a call back from the congressman's office saying he was going to resign.
The congressman himself or his office?
No, his office. We never spoke directly with the congressman.
And what has happened since?
And so since then, we've begun posting these messages, and we've received even more communication from former pages. I've talked to now, I'd say, almost 10 former pages from different years. Few of whom have had direct email interactions with the congressman that were like this, a couple of whom are just friends of people that had these experiences. And the stories are remarkably similar. It always starts as a friendly, hi, how are you doing? And of course, these pages have left the Hill at this point. They're not still working on the Hill, so they want to keep in touch with a congressman contact because they're all aspiring politicians, or at least want to work in that world. And they're trying to chat politics with him, and meanwhile, he's changing the subject to, you know, go measure yourself and what are you wearing? And, you know, one of the questions that keeps coming up is, why didn't anyone report this? But this is after they've left the Hill. There's no dorm proctor to go to. There's no page person to go to, a supervisor. So short of calling the police, there wasn't really a lot of options for these young men. And of course, you know, no one wants to start their political career by being in the center of a sex scandal.
There is a committee, however, that does oversee, because these are kids, oversee, and their parents send them to Washington, mm-hmm. D.C., and they live in a dorm mm-hmm. and get classes at that dorm and also do the page thing. This committee, who sits on this committee?
Well, there are various employees of the House Clerk's Office, and some of them have gone on to be senior staffers for congressmen. And it's one of these, they have each, the Democratic pages and the Republican pages each have separate supervisors that work in the clerk's office. And one of the former pages we spoke to, who was a Republican page, said his supervisor, when they all came in, and this was the fall of 2001, said, somewhat jokingly, but watch out for Congressman Foley. Don't get too involved with him. You know, he's really friendly, but he's a little strange. So it was clear even then that they knew something was up. Maybe they didn't know the exact details of it, but enough people knew that it was well known among every page that I spoke with. Every single page I've spoken with has said everyone knew this was going on.
We're talking to Maddie Sauer, who broke the story with Brian Ross at ABC News of the sexually explicit IMs, instant messaging that was going on, that the congressman was sending to underage pages. Jonathan Kaplan is also with us, staff writer at The Hill newspaper in Washington, D.C. This is exploding on The Hill right now. Jonathan, can you talk about Hastert's response, The Washington Times calling for his resignation?
Well, I think the House leadership is really scrambling to figure out what they knew, when they knew it, and what they did about it. And, you know, they can't all seem to get on the same page. Tom Reynolds, Congressman Alexander from Louisiana he said that he told Congressman Tom Reynolds, who's the chairman of the National Republican Congressional Committee, which means that he's in charge of raising the money and putting together the strategy of getting the House Republican conference reelected this November. Reynolds said he went to Hastert. Hastert said he couldn't remember, but he wasn't going to dispute Reynolds' assertion. And so now we're at this standstill about how to go forward and what happened.
Now, Congressman Foley was co-chair of the Caucus on Missing and Exploited Children. What did he do there?
Well, you know, there are a lot of caucuses. I guess the one thing that sort of and I don't say bothers me, but it's a bit misleading that he was a member of the House Republican leadership. He was an assistant whip or a deputy whip, which technically means he was in the leadership, but he wasn't part of the leadership structure that meets every Tuesday and Wednesday. You know, I was looking at his voting record last night. The one thing that struck me is that he voted against the gay marriage amendment. But there are lots of caucuses in the House. I think there's a caucus for members from steel-producing states. There's probably a sportsman's caucus. And it's basically they share information. It's a policy group, basically.
And so what happens now exactly? Right to the top, Dennis Hastert. He's in trouble. He said he didn't talk about this. Then Reynolds, a Republican from New York, said he did talk to him about it. He said he talked to him about it months ago. Then Hastert did not quite deny this. And then others are saying they've talked about it. And we hear Maddie Sauer talking about the kids who come in as pages being told as far back as 2001, watch out for Congressman Foley.
Well, there's no question there's an institutional crisis. And, I mean, the problem is it's a month before the elections, and I don't think, I mean, this could not have happened at a worse time for them. Things weren't going well to start with. It looked like when they came back from the August recess that there was a little bit of change in momentum. They were going to focus on talking about national security, the war on terrorism. There was the September 11th anniversary, and I mean, the Congress did some big things in the past 2 weeks, but voting to build a fence along the Mexican border, the U.S.-Mexican border, the detainee bill, and some other run-of-the-mill spending stuff that Congress takes care of at the end of every session, but it's all overshadowed by the Foley scandal, and what's going to happen? It's very unclear because everything's very fluid and it's moving way too quickly.
Can you talk about what this means for the Florida race and what this could mean for the balance of the House?
Well, specifically for Mark Foley's congressional district, which is in southern Florida, and basically it looks like in Oklahoma with two stems, one at the top and one at the bottom, and it cuts almost all the way across the state. It's a solid Republican district. His closest election was in 1994 when he first got here. He won with 58% of the vote. He's never gotten that low of, he's won with over 60% ever since. But now, the way it is under Florida law, the county Republican chairman got together over the weekend. They selected a conservative state representative sort of an insurance mogul who's never really run for public office. Well, he's never run for federal office before. And the thing of it is, though, his name won't be on the ballot. So people who go to vote are going to have to vote for Mark Foley. And yesterday on Fox News, John Boehner, the majority leader of the House, basically said that seat's lost. It's gone. That, you know, there's no way that people are going to go into the voting booth, hold their nose, vote for Mark Foley, and make this distinction that it's not really for Foley, it's for this new guy. And as for the balance of the House, let's just say it doesn't make things any easier for them. They already have, a bad environment. People don't think the country's on the right track. The president has low to mediocre approval ratings. Congress itself has horrendous approval ratings, and I can't believe that this helps that at all. I think when the New York Times did their poll last month, the New York Times CBS poll, Congress had a 25% approval rating, 61% disapproval rating, and we haven't seen numbers like that since the early 90s when there was a lot of volatility in American politics.
In reading one of the reports about the man who'll stand in for him, the state senator Negron, he stood beside a 10th grade son, 8th grade daughter, became choked up, put his hands over his face as he started to cry. He said, "I've had pages work in my office for years. I've seen pages," his voice trailing off, putting his hand over his face, struggled to start talking again. "It was very disturbing because I work with these young people." The Democratic nominee, Tim Mahoney, a former Republican and financial advisor who says his campaign won't change. But you do, if you are in that district, have to vote for Congressman Foley, as you said, in order to vote for a Republican, because his name can't be taken off the ballot. And what this means overall for the races, and will it take anyone else down specifically?
That's an excellent question, because, we haven't seen in a very long time whether something that happens in one congressional district affects what goes on in other congressional districts. And I think, again, but as it plays into the overall zeitgeist, and it continues this drip, drip, drip. You have Duke Cunningham, Tom DeLay, Bob Ney, now Mark Foley. You've had, four big resignations this year, all due to scandal. And at least in the case of Cunningham and Ney, not just ethical impropriety, but criminal impropriety.
And Maddie Sauer, the FBI is getting involved with this now?
Oh, yes. They will likely start interviewing pages as early as today.
Why the FBI?
Well, this is one of the things that has disturbed me the most, because at least when these suggestive emails were passed to Rodney Alexander's office, who passed them to Tom Reynolds, the excuse has been, well, we didn't investigate because there was nothing sexual there. It was just a suggestion that, what do you want for your birthday? But the whole point is, if there were these rumors, and if people sort of had a hunch that this was happening, this would have been the perfect opportunity to actually go and investigate. You have emails, you have a child who's complaining, go investigate. Now the FBI is involved. They didn't investigate when they initially got the emails, but they may not have known about these rumors and hunches that people on the Hill had. And because he is soliciting a minor in some of these instances online, where he is saying, let's have dinner, where do you want to meet, I'll pick you up at the airport, that is punishable as soliciting a minor over the internet, because the kid was under 18 at the time, and it's a federal crime, and it is one of the laws that Congressman Foley actually helped to enact.
If these pagers were being warned as early as 2001 by the overall people in the page committee, stay away from Foley, how could other Congress members, Democrat and Republican, not know?
That's to be seen. I'm that's the question now. Who knew and what did they know? Because it seems as if, at the very least, there were staffers at a high level that knew about this, and it is hard to imagine that there are no Congress people out there that did know about this. And that's what we're, of course, looking at next.
Newt Gingrich yesterday on Fox, the former Speaker of the House, defending how the matter was handled, saying Republicans would have been accused of gay bashing if they had overly aggressively reacted to Foley's inappropriate actions.
Well, the issue is this is a minor. I think this, if these were young female pages, this still would have been absolutely unacceptable with a congressman emailing somebody in high school. This is not an issue about whether the congressman is gay or straight. This is an issue about minors and congressional pages that have gone to the Hill to learn about how our country works and, you know, are aspiring to work there themselves one day. It's just, the story is not about whether the congressman's gay or straight.
The next story coming out from ABC?
Well, that's to be determined. We, of course, are hoping to speak to more of these young pages. And, of course, we're hoping to find out who knew exactly what and when. And that's the chain we're trying to follow right now.
Maddie Sauer, thanks so much for joining
My
us.
Pleasure.
I also want to thank Jonathan Kaplan, staff writer at The Hill in Washington, D.C. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute. Augustus Pablo here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. For our next segment, we look at one of this country's most controversial cases involving prosecution of activists for animal rights. Earlier this year, six people were convicted for their role in a campaign to stop animal testing by the British scientific firm Huntingdon Life Sciences. The activists are with a group called Stop Huntingdon Animal Cruelty, or SHAC. Unlike other cases, they were never accused of causing physical damage. Instead, they were convicted of targeting Huntingdon workers, shareholders, and associates by posting personal information about employees and their families on the internet. The case has drawn scrutiny from civil rights advocates who say groups like SHAC have been singled out because they campaign against major corporations. The FBI's called animal rights groups the nation's number one domestic terror threat. Our next guest is a SHAC 7 member whose jail term begins today. Andrew Stepanian has been sentenced to 3 years in prison, the maximum allowed under the Animal Enterprise Protection Act. He's the first SHAC 7 member to go to jail following the convictions. He's speaking with us from Huntington, New York. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Andrew Stepanian. But before we begin, a warning for our television audience. We'll be playing some graphic footage taken of lab tests inside the Huntingdon facility in 1997. The video led the British government to temporarily take away Huntingdon's license. We're also joined by Andrew Erba. He's been one of the lead attorneys in the SHAC 7 case, and he joins us from a studio in Philadelphia. Andrew Stepanian, you are turning yourself in today. Explain what you were convicted of.
I was convicted of one count of a numerous count indictment that came down on both myself and co-defendants, including the corporation Stop Huntingdon Animal Cruelty USA, to which I was not a member. I didn't facilitate a website, but with the website, with the corporation and myself, all of these charges stem from speech-related activity. Whether or not that was speech on the internet or if it was speech engaged at a peaceful demonstration, most done with the oversight of police, and that's where my charge came in. I sat through a court case of about 40 days, and at the end of it, I was convicted mainly on evidence stemming from my attendance at a protest against an auditing firm by the name of Deloitte & Touche. The prosecutors claimed that because Deloitte & Touche severed its relationship with Huntingdon Life Sciences, Huntingdon Life Sciences may have incurred more than $10,000 in damages. And as long as a threshold of $10,000 is met, I could participate in legal activities leading up to that point, but the second I caused $10,000 of intellectual damage, then I could be charged under this conspiracy to violate the Animal Enterprise Protection Act. I would be charged with a substantive charge if I actually destroyed some property, for example, that was worth $10,000. But in this case, it was a purely intellectual matter. And that demonstration in particular, the Nassau County Police in Long Island appeared on the scene. They didn't find any reason to cite any of the people in attendance at the demonstration, including myself. And I was more than open about my attendance at that demonstration. I had no idea that at the end of a 40 or so day trial, that is why I'm going to end up serving 36 months in jail.
Your sentence was upped because you had a party a few weeks ago, a going away party?
Yeah, my mother thought it was a good idea to have a going away party for myself. I used to be a promoter in the punk rock scene a few years ago in Long Island. I also was a talent buyer at a club called The Downtown in Long Island, New York. And so a bunch of bands got together and played a show in my backyard. And the best that I can make of it is that people that were like-minded got together, and there must have been some folks that decided to go out and do a demonstration that night. Again, the demonstration wasn't illegal. No property was damaged, but the fact that a demonstration happened on the same day as my going-away party, it warranted some response from the prosecution during sentencing, saying that I'm a lightning rod for this type of activity, and if I'm not a leader, that I should start acting like a leader and try to stop activism like this on Long Island. It's my contention that at this point, I'm being prosecuted as a leader, and I'm not a leader, and I'm not about to start becoming a leader in this movement and dissuade people from following their hearts and getting involved with activism that I think is righteous.
Andrew Stepanian, let me read you from the Southern Poverty Law Center Intelligence Report. It's by Heidi Byrick and Bob Moser, just the beginning of it.
Okay.
It says, a Chicago insurance executive might seem like one of the last people who'd be opening a letter with this succinctly chilling message, you've been targeted for terrorist attack. But that's what happened last year when a top official at Marsh USA, Inc. was informed that he and his company's employees had landed in the crosshairs of an extremist animal rights group. The reason? Marsh provides insurance for one of the world's biggest animal testing labs. If you bail out now, the letter advised, you, your business, and your family will be spared great hassle and humility. That letter and the harassment campaign that followed after Marsh declined to bail out was another shot fired by Stop Huntingdon Animal Cruelty, or SHAC. This British-born group, now firmly established in the U.S., is waging war on anyone involved with Huntingdon Life Sciences, which tests drugs on approximately 70,000 rats, dogs, monkeys, and other animals each year. In the process, SHAC is rewriting the rules by which even the most radical eco-activists have traditionally operated. In the past, even the edgiest American eco-warriors drew the line at targeting humans. They trumpeted underground activist attacks on businesses and laboratories perceived as abusing animals or the environment. The FBI reports more than 600 incidents, causing $43 million in damages since 96. But spokespeople for the two most active groups in the U.S., Animal Liberation Front, ALF, and Earth Liberation Front, ELF, have always been quick to claim that their underground cells have never injured or killed anyone. Since 99, however, members of both groups have been involved with SHAC's campaign to harass employees of Huntingdon and even distantly related business associates like Marsh, with frankly terroristic tactics similar to those of anti-abortion extremists. Employees have had their homes vandalized with spray-painted puppy killer and will be back notices. They've faced a mounting number of death threats, firebombings, and violent assaults. They've had their names, addresses, and personal information posted on websites and posters, declaring them wanted for collaboration with animal torture. When cowed companies began responding to the harassment by pulling away from Huntingdon, many radical environmentalists cheered, even when SHAC's actions clearly went over the nonviolent line. Your response?
My response to that is that historically, the animal rights movement still to date has never hurt anyone in the United States. And so to somehow say that we're at par with anti-abortion extremists is a bit of a stretch. Anti-abortion extremists obviously have hurt people. I can't be a spokesperson for SHAC, SHAC USA Incorporated, and especially not the activities of SHAC in the UK. I was a volunteer with a group called the Animal Defense League of Long Island, and my involvement with SHAC began the second I was indicted with everybody else in accordance with this conspiracy. All I could really say in regards to what you just repeated to me is that some of that seems grossly exaggerated. And that's just from my experience with sitting in on this trial and the court record. I don't recall any point the prosecutors ever alleging or saying that a letter of that nature ever arose. And I was pretty attentive, taking notes the entire time during the trial. Also, there was never an incident of human-to-human violence that happened in the United States. The historical record will show that things like spray paintings did happen, and demonstrations happened out in front of people's houses. And in fact, I think the most violent rhetoric that was read back into an email was something in regards to, how would you feel if someone treated your child the way these poor animals are being treated? Later on, I read a New York Times article that showed that an FBI agent was misquoting that same exact quote that was given during testimony that was alleged to have been in an email received from an anonymous individual, not SHAC or SHAC USA or SHAC UK or any of the parties sitting there in the court case, but rather an anonymous individual saying, how would you like it if your child was treated that way? And that's open to a great deal of speculation. You can go and say, all right, maybe someone's trying to make someone feel empathy for an animal the way people feel empathy for a child. And there was a lot of room for argument, obviously, in the eyes of the prosecution. But when it comes down to it, at the end of the day, no one was hurt. SHAC USA on their website never advocated for anyone to be hurt. SHAC USA at the bottom of every page, when you load up the HTML, always had a disclaimer that said that we do not advocate any form of violent activity. And in fact, we urge people that when they write letters or they send emails, that they're polite, they're to the point, they're not threatening in nature. And obviously, all that happened on the SHAC USA website was a legal form of reporting. It wasn't you go and go do this or go annoy these people or go harass these people, but rather these are the people that are supporting this laboratory. This is how they put bread on the table. And this is how this company exists. The website existed for a purpose to say, this company is an organism. And there are different things that feed this organism and keep it alive. Whether or not people took that information and did less than savory things, or things that even made myself feel uncomfortable, well, that wasn't necessarily the business of SHAC USA to be responsible for. The only business that they had was reporting on the facts. And all that, no matter how uncomfortable you might say it is protected underneath the First Amendment.
Andrew Stepanian speaking to us before he turns himself in today. And Andrew, let me say that I was reading to you from a fall 2002 article, which doesn't specifically describe the case that you were involved with. Andrew Erba also joins us from Philadelphia, Andrew Stepanian's lawyer. Can you put SHAC 7, this case, in the context of other conspiracy cases?
Well, actually, it's a very important piece of legal actions, because it moves the internet into prosecution. I mean, really what is being prosecuted here is, as Andy said, the posting of notices, the posting of news, the exchange of emails on an internet website. The government says that as a result of this posting of information, which otherwise I think is completely legal and First Amendment protected, other individuals were incited to take actions. But the government has never proven any individual actually read the information on the website and then took an immediate action based on that, which is the test under Brandenburg versus Ohio. And so what we have is a very important extension of a constitutional doctrine into an area which I think affects many activist groups, because certainly if we look on the web today, on the internet, many people hold websites which say things which may be somewhat rhetorical, may be somewhat passionate, and as a result of posting that, if someone should act on that, should that website, should that activist group be held responsible? I think not under the First Amendment.
Andrew Erber, can you compare the Animal Enterprise Protection Act, an industry-specific statute that provides harsher sentences for those protesting animal-related businesses than perhaps those protesting women's health clinics around the issue of abortion?
Well, one of the things we have to understand is that, and this is one of our arguments will be in the Third Circuit, that the government is really misconstruing the Animal Enterprise Protection Act. It's a very specific act, and what it really prohibits is someone who would go on the property of an animal enterprise and free an animal that's in an experiment, or break a window, or knock down a door. I mean, do something physically in a trespass action. And what the government has done in this case is transmute that into an action which says that if I organize activities which may lead to someone organizing against an animal enterprise, they're held responsible. And this is in direct contradiction to the legislation under the abortion statutes or the anti-abortion statutes, which really talk about a specific action, a person picketing an abortion clinic, a person preventing a woman from entering an abortion clinic. So in one sense, the government has accepted that it has to have a greater nexus, but with the Animal Enterprise Protection Act, they've lost that nexus and really are prosecuting people who merely advocate having a movement against the various animal enterprise. And so therefore, we feel it's a gross extension of what Congress intended under the act.
Andrew Stepanian, if you had this all to do again, would you do it differently?
I would have to say no. I mean, I have a minimal involvement with this from start to finish. And my only involvement was with the Animal Defense League of Long Island, a group that's been acclaimed by local politicians. I recently got an award from both the U.S. military and the United States Humane Society for my work down in New Orleans, helping right after Hurricane Katrina. And, you know, it's like, These are activities that I partake in with my affinity group and my activists in Long Island, and I'm proud to be working with them. What motivated us to help the people down in New Orleans is exactly what motivated us to get involved with, you know, picketing Deloitte and Touche, saying that they shouldn't support the murder of 180,000 animals each day. And with closing that, you know, I think that what scares me is that it doesn't end here. Currently, there's Senate subcommittee hearings that are trying to broaden these laws and have them go after other specific focus activist groups. And if I can quote Senator James Einhoff, a Republican from Oklahoma, dated October 26th of 2005, he says, "It seems to me unimaginable that this country's worldwide symbol of the integrity of capital markets, the New York Stock Exchange, would capitulate to threats, or in this case, even the mere threat of threats, from a single-issue extremist group. Appeasing these groups only validates their effectiveness and the effectiveness of their tactics and inspires them to replicate this model of activism in some sort of other venue. What then happens when the activists move to the timber, the defense, or some sort of other controversial industry?" And I interpret that and that entire Senate subcommittee hearing as they don't want effective models of activism like the Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty campaign to be applied to anti-war activism, to be applied to women's health issues, to be applied to civil rights issues, to be applied to, for example, a great model would be organizing against sweatshops. And this is something that obviously is important to me, and I'm ready to go to the Third Circuit. I'm ready to appeal, and I'm ready to win on this issue because I think that at the end of the day, I'm not willing to have my name brought up in the middle of a battle that loses and thus chills free speech for all types of people that believe in all different kinds of issues around this country. Even issues I don't agree with. I want people to have that freedom to go do what they want to do.
Andrew, how old are you?
28 years old. I'm going to be 31 when I get out. And obviously, it's stressful. www.shack7.com is a website where people can get in touch with how to write us letters or how to donate to legal defense. And it has not only bios on myself, but my other co-defendants, great individuals like Kevin Jonas, Lauren Gazzola, Darius Fulmer, Jacob Conroy, and Josh Harper. They all could use letters when we're all in jail. And we obviously want to thank our supporters that are out there.
And where will you turn yourself in?
I'm turning myself in on Cadman Plaza West today at the U.S. Courthouse. I'm going to be meeting up with some U.S. Marshals there, and I do believe that they're going to be taking me to the Metropolitan Detention Complex in Brooklyn.
I want to thank you for joining us, Andrew Stepanian, and Andrew Erba, your attorney, joining us from Philadelphia. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute.
Until the philosophy which owed one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned. Everywhere is war. It's a war that until there are no longer first class and second class citizens of any nation, until the color of a man's skin is of no more significance than the color of his eyes. Miss a war that until the
war. Bob Marley here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Army medic Augustine Aguayo, Specialist Mark Wilkerson, Specialist Suzanne Swift, Lieutenant Aaron Watada, Sergeant Ricky Klausing. Those are just some of the American service members we've interviewed recently who are refusing deployments to Iraq. Well, today we bring you a new voice. Private Darrell Anderson came back from Iraq nearly 2 years ago with a Purple Heart and an order for a second deployment. Instead, he fled to Canada, where he's been until this week. Private Anderson returned to the United States, where he could face charges. He'll be turning himself in to the military later today. He joins us from Lexington, Kentucky. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Can you tell us why you're turning yourself in today?
Basically, it was I just couldn't live up in Canada no more without work permits and health care and the support of my family while dealing with post-traumatic stress from Iraq and everything. And also I feel that I want to put on my uniform and stand on a military base and resist the war, because it was something that I wasn't strong enough to do before.
Why don't you tell us when you went to Iraq, when you returned, and why you decided not to go back?
Oh, it was just, as soon as I got to Iraq, it was obvious that everything we were doing there was wrong, and there was no justification of it. And I believe that if I returned to Iraq and followed military procedures and orders, that there was no way around it, I would eventually kill innocent people. And I believed it was my human right to choose not to do so, and it was my military duty to resist this war.
Where were you in Iraq, and at what point when you went to Iraq did you decide that you felt you couldn't fight there anymore?
I arrived in Baghdad in January of 04, and it was in April of 04 when I was ordered to open fire on a car of innocent civilians, and I refused, and my superiors told me that it was military procedures. If a car comes through a traffic stop, you are ordered to open fire, and I just didn't agree with our procedures we were doing there, because if I followed them, I would be killing innocent people.
And so what happened?
I refused. They told me if I did refuse again, I'd be punished. But I was still a fresh troop on the ground, so no action was taken. And just events like that just kept occurring until one day I saw a couple of my fellow soldiers get hit, and I pulled my trigger while pointing it at an innocent child, but my weapon was unsafe, and then I realized what I was doing, and I just realized that no matter how good or stance you believe you are when you're there, that you're eventually, you know, the evil is going to take over and you're going to kill people.
So, Private Darrell Anderson, you came back to the United States, you were deployed again. How did you escape to Canada?
Actually, I'm a specialist, Anderson. I was a specialist in the U.S. Army. It came that at the time I went AWOL, there was no support. in the U.S. There wasn't that big of anti-war movements, and I couldn't get support from the military to deal with the nightmares. And the only place I found support was in Canada through the War Resistance Support Campaign, and that was pretty much the only thing that saved my life at the time with all the stuff I was going through.
How did you leave your base to go to Canada?
I was home for Christmas leave in Kentucky from Germany, and it was then that I decided with my family that going to Canada was our best option. My family drove me to Canada through the night, so I was actually in Canada before I was even AWOL from the Army.
And how did you live in Canada over this last year and a half?
Working under the table, cheap labor, construction, cooking, just scraping by with the, also had support from the campaign up there. And I went to a psychiatrist a few times, but I just couldn't afford to have transportation to get there anymore. And so I wasn't living very well, but I had my freedom for the time I was there.
Daryl Anderson, you were wounded yourself in Iraq. Describe what happened.
We were in a howitzer, and one of my fellow soldiers took shrapnel from an RPG, and I took his place on top of the vehicle through a hatch, and it was like an hour or so later that two IEDs blew up, and I took shrapnel on my side, and I felt the burning, and I pulled the piece of metal out, and I saw the blood, and just like the guy before me, I fell back into the vehicle, taking all my my gear off, you know, asking my fellow soldiers if I'm going to die, am I going to be okay? And once they decided, the sergeant said, it didn't go in, you're going to be okay. And he went to take my place, and I grabbed him by his gear, and I pulled him down, and I went back up and stood my ground after I'd been hit.
You won a Purple Heart for this.
Yes, I was awarded a Purple Heart when we returned to Germany. Some major pinned it on me, and there was a big ceremony and stuff like that. But it didn't really mean much because the same guy that got hit the same day I did, who was severely injured, he was up in his room, isolated from all the other soldiers, and they're putting me on display because I was injured, but I was able to continue. So as soon as they gave me my Purple Heart, it really didn't mean anything to me because they weren't giving my friend his Purple Heart because he was getting kicked out of the military.
So what happens to you today?
I turn myself in, I make my last stance, and I take whatever's coming. The last couple months, I believed I was going to do a year or two in jail on my return, but through my lawyer talking to Fort Knox, they said that they're going to release me in 3 to 5 days and not court-martial me and everything. So right now I'm kind of just hoping they stay to their word and I can get out in a week and start more counseling. But I don't know exactly what's going to happen because the military is known for telling you one thing and doing another.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, and we will continue to follow your case. That does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Frank Lopez, Aaron Mate, Jen Youth. Special thanks to Nick Marsilio and as well to Uri Galed and Flip Mike DeFilippo. Tomorrow night on Wednesday, we'll be at Mount Holyoke, Mary Woolley Hall. On Friday night at the Britt Auditorium at Southern Oregon University in Ashland. We'll be in Walnut Creek, California, Sacramento, and Palo Alto on Saturday. On Sunday in Burlington, Vermont, and next week we'll be in Buffalo. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. Our website, democracynow.org. See you tomorrow.